Oh, no, said Sergeant Colon. He promised he wasn't going to touch it any more. Look, he's had a whole bottle.
What is it? Bear, Haggis, said Nobby.
Shouldn't think so. He's still breathing. Come on, help me up with him.
The night watch clustered around. Carrot had deposited Captain Vimes on a chair in the middle of the watchhouse floor. Angua picked out the bottle and looked at the label. C.M.O.T. Dibbler's Genuine Authentic Soggy Mountain Dew, she read. He's going to die. It says 150% proof.
Nah, that's just old Dibbler's advertising, said Nobby. It ain't got no proof, just circumstantial evidence.
Why hasn't he got his sword? Said Angua. Vimes opened his eyes. The first thing he saw was the concerned face of Nobby.
Brr, he said. So, give it away, hooray.
What? Said Colon.
No more. Whoosh. Ogre.
I think he's a bit drunk, said Carrot.
Drunk? Who's a drunk? Who'd Jack or me drunk if I was sober?
Get him some coffee, said Angua.
I reckon he's beyond our coffee, said Colon. Nobby, nip along to Fat Sally's in Squeezebelly Alley and get a jug of that special clatchy and stuff. Not a metal jug, mind.
Vimes blinked as they manhandled him into a chair.
All go away, he said. Bang, bang. Lady Sybil's going to be really mad, said Nobby. You know he promised to leave it alone.
Captain Vimes, said Carrot.
Hmm?
How many fingers am I holding up? How many hands, then?
Four. Blimey, I haven't seen him like this for years, said Colon. Here, let me try some. Want another drink, Captain?
He certainly doesn't need an...
Shut up, I know what I'm doing. Another drink, Captain Vimes?
Mm-hmm.
I've never known him not to be able to give a loud, clear yes, said Colon, standing back. I think we'd better get him up to his room.
I'll take him, poor chap, said Carrot. He lifted Vimes easily and slung him over his shoulder. I hate to see him like this, said Angua, following him into the hallway and up the stairs.
He only drinks when he gets depressed, said Carrot.
Why does he get depressed?
Sometimes it's because he hasn't had a drink.
The house in Pseudopolis Yard had originally been a Ramkin family residence. Now the first floor was occupied by the guards on an ad hoc basis. Carrot had a room. Nobby had rooms consecutively, four so far, moving out when the floor became hard to find, and Vimes had a room. More or less. It was hard to tell. Even a prisoner in a cell manages to stamp his personality on it somewhere, but Angua had never seen such an unlived-in room.
"This is where he lives?"
said Angua.
"Good grief!
What did you expect?"
"I don't know. Anything. Something. Not nothing."
There was a joyless iron bedstead. The springs and mattress had sagged so that they formed a sort of mould, forcing anyone who got into it to instantly fold into a sleeping position. There was a washstand under a broken mirror. On the stand was a razor carefully aligned towards the hub, because Vimes shared the folk belief that this kept it sharp. There was a brown wooden chair with the cane seat broken, and a small chest at the foot of the bed. And that was all.
I mean, at least a rug, said Angua, a picture on the wall. Something.
Carrot deposited Vimes on the bed where he flowed unconsciously into the shape.
Haven't you got something in your room?
Angua asked.
Yes, I've got a cutaway diagram of number 5 shaft at home. It's very interesting strata. I helped cut it. And some books and things. Captain Vimes isn't really an indoors kind of person.
But there's not even a candle.
He finds his way to bed by memory, he says.
Or an ornament, or anything.
There's a sheet of cardboard under the bed, Carrot volunteered. I remember I was with him in Filigree Street when he found it. He said, there's a month's souls in this, if I'm any judge. He was very pleased about that.
He can't even afford boots?
I don't think so. I know Lady Sybil offered to buy him all the new boots he wanted, and he got a bit offended about that. He seems to try to make them last.
But you can buy boots, and you get less than him, and you send money home.
He must drink it all, the idiot.
Don't think so. I didn't think he'd touch the stuff for months. Lady Sybil got him onto cigars.
Vimes snored loudly.
"How can you admire a man like this?" said Angua. "He's a very fine man." Angua raised the lid of the wooden chest with her foot. "Hey, I don't think you should do that," said Carrot wretchedly.
"I'm just looking," said Angua. "No law against that."
"In fact, under the Privacy Act of 1467, it is an aff—"
"There's only old boots and stuff, and some paper."
She reached down and picked up a crudely made book. It was merely a wad of irregular-shaped bits of paper sandwiched together between card covers. "That belongs to the captain." She opened the book and read a few lines. Her mouth dropped open.
"Will you look at this? No wonder he never has any money."
"What do you mean?"
"He spends it on women. You wouldn't think it, would you? Look at this entry, 4 in 1 week.
Carrot looked over her shoulder. On the bed, Vimes snorted. There on the page, in Vimes's curly handwriting, were the words, "Mrs. Gaskin, Mincing Street, $5. Mrs. Skurrick, Treacle Street, $4. Mrs. Maroon, Wigson's Alley, $4. Annabel Curry, Lobsneaks, $2.
"Annabel Curry couldn't have been much good for only $2, said Angua.
She was aware of a sudden drop in temperature.
"I shouldn't think so," said Carrot slowly. "She's only 9 years old.
One of his hands gripped her wrist tightly, and the other prized the book out of her fingers.
"Hey, let go!"
"Sergeant," shouted Carrot over his shoulder, "can you come up here a moment?" Angua tried to pull away. Carrot's arm was as immovable as an iron bar. There was a creak of Colon's foot on the stair, and the door swung open. He was holding a very small cup in a pair of tongs.
"Nobby got the coffee," he began and stopped.
"Sergeant," said Carrot, staring into Angua's face.
"Lance Constable Angua wants to know about Mrs. Gaskin."
"Old Leggy Gaskin's widow. She lives in Mincing Street."
"And Mrs. Skurrick?"
"In Treacle Street. Takes in laundry now."
Sergeant Colon looked from one to the other, trying to get a handle on the situation.
"Mrs. Maroon?"
"That's Sergeant Maroon's widow. She sells coal."
"How about Annabel Curry?"
"She still goes to the Spiteful Sisters of Seven-Handed Sec Charity School, doesn't she?"
Colon smiled nervously at Angua, still not sure of what was happening.
"She's the daughter of Corporal Curry, but of course he was before your time."
Angua looked up at Carrot's face. His expression was unreadable.
"They're the widows of coppers," she said.
He nodded.
"And one orphan."
"It's a tough old life," said Colon. "No pensions for a widow, see?"
He looked from one to the other.
"Is there something wrong?" he said.
Carrot relaxed his grip, turned, slipped the book into the box and shut the lid.
"No," he said. "Look, I'm sorry," Angua began.
Carrot ignored her and nodded at the sergeant.
"Give him the coffee." "But $14, that's nearly half his pay."
Carrot picked up Vimes's limp arm and tried to prise his fist open, but even though Vimes was out cold, the fingers were locked.
"I mean, half his pay."
"I don't know what he's holding in here," said Carrot, ignoring her. "Maybe it's a clue." He took the coffee and hauled Vimes up by his collar.
"You just drink this, Captain," he said, "and everything will look a lot clearer."
Clatchian coffee has an even bigger sobering effect than an unexpected brown envelope from the taxman. In fact, coffee enthusiasts take the precaution of getting thoroughly drunk before touching the stuff, because Clatchian coffee takes you back through sobriety, and if you're not careful, out the other side, where the mind of man should not go. The watch was generally of the opinion that Samuel Vimes was at least 2 drinks under par, and needed a stiff double even to be sober.
"Careful, careful," Carrot let a few drops dribble between Vimes' lips. "And look, when I said—"
Angua began.
"Forget it."
Carrot didn't even look round.
"I was only—" "I said forget it."
Vimes opened his eyes and took a look at the world and screamed.
"Nobby." "Yes, Sarge?" "Did you buy the Red Desert Special or the Curly Mounted Straight?" "Red Desert, Sarge, because—"
"You could have said, better get me—"
He glanced at Vimes's grimace of horror.
"Half a glass of Bear Huggers. We've sent him too far the other way."
The glass was fetched and administered. Vimes unstiffened as it took effect. His palm uncurled.
"Oh, my gods," said Angua. "Have we got any bandages?"
The sky was a little white circle high above.
"Where the hell are we, partner?" said Cuddy.
"Cave."
"No caves under Ankh-Morpork. It's on loam."
Cuddy had fallen about 30 feet, but had cushioned the fall because he landed on Detritus's head. The troll had been sitting, surrounded by rotting woodwork, in, well, a cave. Or Cuddy thought, as his eyes grew accustomed to the gloom, a stone-lined tunnel.
"I didn't do nothing," said Detritus. "I just stood there, next minute everything going past upwards."
Cuddy reached down into the mud underfoot and brought up a piece of wood. It was very thick. It was also very rotten.
"We fell through something, into something," he said.
He ran his hand over the curved tunnel wall.
"And this is good masonry. Very good."
"How do we get out?"
There was no way to climb back. The tunnel roof was much higher than Detritus.
"We walk out, I think."
He sniffed the air, which was dank. Dwarfs have a very good sense of direction underground.
"This way,"
he added, setting off.
"Cuddy?"
"Yes?"
"No one ever say there are tunnels under the city. No one know about them."
"So?"
"So there no way out. Because way out is way in, too. And if no one know about the tunnels, then it cause no way in."
"But they've got to lead somewhere."
"Okay."
Black mud, more or less dry, made a path at the bottom of the tunnel. There was slime on the walls, too, indicating that at some point in the recent past the tunnel had been full of water. Here and there, huge patches of fungi, luminous with decay, cast a faint glow over the ancient stonework. It didn't need to. Cuddy, belonging to a race that worked underground for preference, and Detritus, a member of a race notoriously nocturnal, had excellent vision in the dark. But mysterious caves and tunnels always have luminous fungi, strangely bright crystals, or at a pinch merely an eldritch glow in the air, just in case a human hero comes in and needs to see in the dark. Strange, but true. Cuddy felt his spirits lift as he plodded through the darkness. Dwarfs always felt happier underground.
"Bound to find a way out," he said.
"Right.
So, how come you joined the watch then?"
"Huh. My girl Ruby, she say, you want to get married, you get a proper job. I not marry a troll, what people say, him no good troll. Him thick as a short plank of wood."
Detritus's voice echoed in the darkness. "How about you?"
"I got bored. I work for my brother-in-law Durance. He's got a good business making fortune rats for dwarf restaurants, but I thought, this isn't a proper job for a dwarf."
"Sound like easy job to me."
"I had the devil of a time getting them to swallow the fortunes."
Cuddy stopped. A change in the air suggested a vaster tunnel up ahead. And indeed, the tunnel opened into the side of a much larger one. There was deep mud on the floor, in the middle of which ran a trickle of water. Cuddy fancied he heard rats, or what he hoped were rats, scuttle away into the dark emptiness. He even thought he could hear the sounds of the city, indistinct, intermingled, filtering through the earth.
"It's like a temple,"
he said, and his voice boomed away into the distance.
"Writing here on wall," said Detritus.
Cuddy peered at the letters hacked deeply into the stone.
"Via Cloaca," he said. "Hmm. Well now, via is an old word for street or way. Cloaca means..."
He peered into the gloom.
"This is a sewer," he said. "What's that?" "It's like... well, where do trolls dump their... rubbish?" said Cuddy.
"In street," said Detritus. "Hey, Genic."
"This is an underground street just for... well, for crap," said Cuddy. "I never knew Ankh-Morpork had them."
"Maybe Ankh-Morpork didn't know Ankh-Morpork had them," said Detritus.
"Right. You're right. This place is old. We're in the bowels of the earth."
"In Ankh-Morpork, even the shit have a street to itself," said Detritus,
awe and wonder in his voice.
"Truly, this is a land of opportunity."
"Here's some more writing," said Cuddy.
He scraped away some slime.
"Chirone the fourth may fabricat,"
he read aloud.
"He was one of the early kings, wasn't he? Hey, do you know what that means?"
"No one's been down here since yesterday,"
said Detritus.
"No. This place is more than 2,000 years old. We're quite probably the first people to come down here since...
yesterday,"
said the troll.
Yesterday? What's yesterday got to do with it?
Footprints still fresh, said Detritus. He pointed. There were footprints in the mud.
How long have you lived here?
Said Cuddy, suddenly feeling very conspicuous in the middle of the tunnel.
9 years. That is the number of years I have lived here. 9-er,
said Detritus proudly.
It only one of a large number of numbers I can count to. Have you ever heard of tunnels under the city?
No.
Someone knows about them, though.
Yes.
What shall we do?
The answer was inevitable. They'd chased a man into the pork futures warehouse and nearly died. Then they'd ended up in the middle of a small war and nearly died. Now they were in a mysterious tunnel where there were fresh footprints. If Corporal Carrot or Sergeant Colon said, "And what did you do then?" neither of them could face up to the thought of saying, "We came back."
"The footprints go this way," said Cuddy, "and then they return. But the ones coming back aren't so deep as the ones going. You can see the later ones because they're over the top of the other ones. So he was heavier going than he was coming back, yes?"
"Right," said Detritus.
"So that means he lose weight. He was carrying something, and he left it up ahead somewhere."
They stared at the darkness.
"So we go and find out what it was," said Detritus.
"I think so. How do you feel?"
"Feel okay."
Different species though they were, their minds had focused on a single image involving a muzzle flash and a lead slug singing through the subterranean night.
"He came back," said Cuddy.
"Yes," said Detritus.
They looked at the darkness again.
"It has not been a nice day," said Cuddy.
"That the truth?
I'd just like to know something in case, I mean... Look, what happened in the pork store? You did all that maths, all that counting."
"I dunno. I saw it all."
"All what?"
"Just all of it, everything. All the numbers in the world, I could count them all."
"What did they equal?"
"Dunno. What does equal mean?"
They trudged on to see what the future held. The trail led eventually into a narrower tunnel, barely wide enough for the troll to stand upright. Finally, they could go no further. A stone had dropped out of the roof, and rubble and mud had percolated through, blocking the tunnel. But that didn't matter, because they'd found what they were looking for, even though they hadn't been looking for it.
"Oh, dear," said Detritus. "Very definitely," said Cuddy.
He looked around vaguely.
"You know," he said, "I reckon these tunnels are usually full of water. They're well below the normal river level."
He looked back to the pathetic discovery.
"There's going to be a lot of trouble about this," he said.
"It's his badge," said Carrot. "Good grief, he's holding it so tight, it's cut right into his hand."
Technically, Ankh-Morpork pork is built on loam, but what it is mainly built on is Ankh-Morpork pork. It has been constructed, burned down, silted up and rebuilt so many times that its foundations are old cellars, buried roads, and the fossil bones and middens of earlier cities. Below these, in the darkness, sat the troll and the dwarf.
"What we doing now?"
"We ought to leave it here and fetch Corporal Carrot. He'll know what to do."
Detritus looked over his shoulder at the thing behind them.
"I don't like that," he said. "It's not right to leave it here."
"Right, yes, you're right. But you're a troll and I'm a dwarf. What do you think would happen if people saw us carrying that along the streets?"
"Big trouble."
"Correct. Come on, let's follow the footprints back out."
"Supposing it's gone when we come back," said Detritus, lumbering to his feet.
"How? And we're following the tracks out, so if whoever it was put it there comes back, we'll run straight into them."
"Oh, good. I'm glad you said that."
Vimes sat on the edge of his bed while Angua bandaged his hand.
"Captain Quirk," said Carrot. "But he's not a good choice."
"Mayonnaise Quirk, we used to call him," said Colon. "He's a pillock."
"Don't tell me," said Angua. "He's rich, thick and oily, yes?"
"And smells faintly of eggs," said Carrot.
"Plumes on his helmet," said Colon, "and a breastplate you can see your face in."
"Well, Carrot's got one of those too," said Nobby.
"Yes, but the difference is Carrot keeps his armour polished because he likes nice clean armour," said Colon loyally, "while Quirk keeps his shiny because he's a pillock."
"But he's wrapped up the case," said Nobby. "I heard about it when I went out for the coffee. He's arrested Coalface, the troll, you know, Captain, the privy cleaner. Someone saw him near Rhyme Street just before the dwarf got killed."
"But he's massive," said Carrot. "He couldn't have got through the door."
"He's got a motive," said Nobby.
"Yes?"
"Yes. Hammerhock was a dwarf."
"That's not a motive."
"It is for a troll. Anyway, if he didn't do that, he probably did something. There's plenty of evidence against him."
"Like what?" said Angua.
"He's a troll."
"That's not evidence."
"It is to Captain Quirk," said the sergeant. "He's bound to have done something," Nobby repeated.
In this, he was echoing the patrician's view of crime and punishment. If there was crime, there should be punishment. If the specific criminal should be involved in the punishment process, then this was a happy accident. But if not, then any criminal would do. And since everyone was undoubtedly guilty of something, the net result was that, in general terms, justice was done.
"He's a nasty piece of work, that Coalface," said Colon. "A right-hand troll for Chrysopraise."
"Yes, but he couldn't have killed Bjorn," said Carrot. "And what about the beggar girl?"
Vimes sat looking at the floor.
"What do you think, Captain?" said Carrot.
Vimes shrugged.
"Who cares?" he said.
"Well, you care," said Carrot. "You always care. We can't let even someone like..."
"Listen to me," said Vimes in a small voice. "Supposing we'd found who killed the dwarf and the clown, or the girl, it wouldn't make any difference. It's all rotten anyway."
"What is, Captain?" said Colon.
"All of it. You might as well try and empty a well with a sieve. Let the assassins try and sort it out, or the thieves. He can try the rats next. Why not? We're not the people for this. We ought to have just stayed with ringing our bells and shouting all's well."
"But all isn't well, Captain," said Carrot.
"So what? When has that ever mattered?"
"Oh dear," said Angua under her breath. "I think perhaps you gave him too much of that coffee."
Vimes said, "I'm retiring from the watch tomorrow. 25 years on the streets."
Nobby started to grin nervously and stopped as the sergeant, without apparently shifting position, grabbed one of his arms and twisted it gently but meaningfully up his back.
"And what good's it all been? What good have I done? I've just worn out a lot of boots. There's no place in Ankh-Morpork for policemen. Who cares what's right or wrong? Assassins and thieves and trolls and dwarfs. Might as well have a bloody king and be done with it."
The rest of the night watch stood looking at their feet in mute embarrassment. Then Carrot said, "It's better to light a candle than curse the darkness, Captain. That's what they say."
"What?"
Vimes' sudden rage was like a thunderclap.
"Who says that? When has that ever been true? It's never been true. It's the kind of thing people without power say to make it all seem less bloody awful, but it's words. It never makes any difference."
Someone hammered at the door.
"That'll be Quirk," said Vimes. "You're to hand over your weapons. The night watch is being stood down for a day. Can't have coppers running around upsetting things, can we? Open the door, Carrot."
"But..." Carrot began.
"That was an order. I might not be any good for anything else, but I could bloody well order you to open the door, so open the door."
Quirk was accompanied by half a dozen members of the day watch. They had crossbows. In deference to the fact that they were doing a mildly unpleasant job involving fellow officers, they had them pointing slightly downwards. In deference to the fact that they weren't damn fools, they had the safety catches off. Quirk wasn't actually a bad man. He didn't have the imagination. He dealt more in the sort of generalised low-grade unpleasantness which slightly tarnishes the soul of all who come into contact with it. Rather like British Rail. Many people are in jobs that are a little beyond them, but there are ways of reacting to the situation. Sometimes they're flustered and nice. Sometimes they're Quirk. Quirk handled them with the maxim, "It doesn't matter if you're right or wrong, so long as you're definite." There was, on the whole, no real racial prejudice in Ankh-Morpork. When you've got dwarfs and trolls, the mere colour of other humans is not a major item, but Quirk was the kind of man to whom it comes naturally to pronounce the word Negro with two G's. He had a hat with plumes in it.
"Come in, come in," said Vimes. "It wasn't as if we were doing anything."
"Captain Vimes,
"It's all right, we know. Give him your weapons, people. That's an order, Carrot. One official-issue sword, one pike or halberd, one nightstick or truncheon, one crossbow. That's right, isn't it, Sergeant Colon?"
"Yes, sir."
Carrot hesitated only a moment. "Oh, well," he said, "my official sword is in the rack." "What's that one on your belt?" Carrot said nothing. However, he shifted position slightly, his biceps strained against the leather of his jerkin.
"Official sword, great," said Quirk.
He turned. He was one of those people who would recoil from an assault on strength, but attack weakness without mercy.
"Where's the grit sucker?" he said. "And the rock?"
"Ah," said Vimes, "you are referring to those representative members of our fellow sapient races who have chosen to throw in their lots with people of this city?"
"I mean the dwarf and the troll," said Quirk.
"Haven't the faintest idea," said Vimes cheerfully. It seemed to Angua that he was drunk again, if people could get drunk on despair.
"We don't know, sir," said Colon. "Haven't seen him all day."
"Probably fainting up in Quarry Lane with the rest of them," said Quirk. "You can't trust people of their tape. You ought to know that."
And it also seemed to Angua that although words like half-pint and grit-sucker were offensive, they were as terms of universal brotherhood compared to words like people of their type in the mouth of men like Quirk. Much to her shock, she found her gaze concentrating on the man's jugular vein.
"Fighting?" said Carrot. "Why?"
Quirk shrugged.
"Who knows?"
"Let me think now," said Vimes. "It could be something to do with a wrongful arrest. It could be something to do with some of the more restless dwarfs just needing any excuse to have a go at the trolls. What do you think, Quirk?"
"I don't think, Vimes."
"Good man, you're just the type the city needs." Vimes stood up.
"I'll be going then," he said. "I'll see you all tomorrow, if there is one."
The door slammed behind him. This hall was huge. It was the size of a city square with pillars every few yards to support the roof. Tunnels radiated off it in every direction and at various heights in the walls. Water trickled out of many of them from small springs and underground streams. That was the problem. The film of running water over the stone floor of the hall had wiped away traces of the footprints. A very large tunnel, almost blocked with debris and silt, led off in what Cuddy was pretty sure was the direction of the estuary. It was almost pleasant. There was no smell other than a damp under-a-stone mustiness, and it was cool.
"I've seen big dwarf halls in the mountains," said Cuddy, "but I've got to admit this is something else."
His voice echoed back and forth in the chamber.
"Oh, yes," said Detritus. "It's got to be something else, because it's not a dwarf hall in the mountains."
"Can you see any way up?"
"No."
"We could have passed a dozen ways to the surface and not known it."
"Yes," said the troll. "It's a knotty problem."
"Detritus?"
"Yes."
"Did you know you're getting smarter again down here in the cool?"
"Really?"
"Can you use it to think of a way out?"
"Digging?"
the troll suggested. There were fallen blocks here and there in the tunnels. Not many. The place had been well built.
"Nah, haven't got a shovel," said Cuddy.
Detritus nodded.
"Give me your breastplate," he said.
He leaned it up against the wall. His fist pounded into it a few times. He handed it back. It was, more or less, shovel-shaped.
"It's a long way up," Cuddy said doubtfully.
"But we know the way," said Detritus. "It's either that or stay down here eating rat for the rest of your life."
Cuddy hesitated. The idea had a certain appeal.
"Without ketchup," Detritus added.
"I think I saw a fallen stone just away back there," said the dwarf.